This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about body dysmorphia with Hannah Hickenbotham. And this is a theme that even after, what are we now, 230 episodes plus, I am even kind of surprised that we haven't talked about. It's something that relates a lot to some of my own personal experiences and is part of a lot of people's experiences when it comes to eating disorders. But it's, of course, so worth having an episode all about body dysmorphia, not only because what a big factor it can be in so many people's mental health, but also because not everyone knows that body dysmorphic disorder is its own condition and therefore can be a totally standalone diagnosis. As you'll hear in Hannah's experience, getting that diagnosis alongside the one for her eating disorder was actually a big part of better understanding her mental health in general and what she could do to get the right kind of support. So a super broad conversation today, one that I was so glad to have, and with a guest who I'm such a big fan of. She is host of the Full of Beans podcast, which has shared many guests with this show, which is actually how I found out about it first. And it's kind of like if you're looking for the closest equivalent to our show, but one centered primarily around eating disorders, it's worth checking out for her. It's worth checking out for the really fun artwork. I'm not going to give you any spoilers, but it's funky. And in addition to being host of that show, Han is also a campaigner and public speaker around topics of mental health and a registered nutritionist, so can understand both through her own personal experience and her study and work since then, the impact that eating disorders can, of course, have so much on your physical health as well. And I think it's worth putting a bit of a pin in that as well, because we talked about off-air how this is one of the areas that strangely hasn't come up during the pandemic, that in many ways we've said before on the show that Danny and I have been pleasantly surprised in a lot of ways that mental health has been covered to such an extent and in often appropriate ways in relation to what a big factor that has been in pandemic experiences, alongside the impacts of like loneliness, isolation, people's financial situations changing. A lot of the conversation has had mental health at its core, which is, you know, always improvements to be made, but it's good to see a lot of those conversations are being had. However, something that I think has been kind of missed is that in many ways, mental health conditions can be a vulnerability when we talk about COVID. They can be one of these pre-existing conditions that can make you more vulnerable to severity of illness. And eating disorders in many ways are one of the easiest to explain examples here. And many eating disorders are an example of this, where when your physical health and oftentimes your immune system is impacted by lack of nutrients, lack of food in general, potentially too much food can also be a factor, the instability of intakes of nutrients. There are a lot of ways that a lot of different eating disorders can affect your immunity and your ability to heal from all kinds of illness. So if no one else is going to mention it, we're going to mention it here. And so with that all said, we'll get into this episode in a moment. If you're a subscriber, you're about to hear no ads. If you are not, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. In a world of unknowns, one thing you can start the day with is a better shave thanks to Harry's. Whilst the quality of razors can vary so wildly, blunt easily and be super expensive, I'm glad to share a brand that's so committed to value and quality, they launched with their very own factory and have since won over more than 20 million customers. Now Harry's have expanded into shower gels, face wash and skincare products so you can combine a closer shave with clean and clearer skin. You can try Harry's for yourself with a free trial set delivered right to your door, including an expertly weighted razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover. And especially for our listeners, a bonus shower gel by going to harrys.com/mentalhealth right now. That's harrys.com/mentalhealth. You'll just pay shipping, so there's nothing to lose, but a more comfortable face to gain.
My name is Hannah, and I think I was about in year two, and I had some Wotsits for snack at break time, like every child did. And I remember looking at them, and just before that, a boy at school had called me chubby. And so I just threw them in the bin and thought, I don't need those. I can start restricting my food. Yeah, that's where it started, I guess.
Wow. And so we mentioned off air that even before that point, you were aware of sort of having a warped view towards your appearance. And so do you think there was body dysmorphia existing before that, or maybe a sort of almost precondition to perhaps external stimuli triggering certain symptoms?
I think so. I think my kind of perception of self has, I never thought it was distorted at the time, but when I look back at pictures, even at that age and maybe before, I always thought that I was kind of the chubbier one in my friendship group or the bigger one. And actually looking back in the pictures, I'm no different. Mm-hmm. But I guess at that age, you know, I've got so much self-awareness now that I can be like, that's kind of the body dysmorphia talking. But at that age, it's just, I had no idea. So I just thought that was me. I guess my environment at home, my mum had always been on a diet, my grandma had always been on a diet, everyone around me was trying to manipulate their diet in order to change what they looked like. And whatever kind of flaw they picked up on their own body, that was just passed on to me. Because obviously, if you're kind of the person that you look up to is saying, I hate this about myself, I want to change it, you're inevitably going to think, oh yeah, I hate that about myself too. Or, you know, do I need to change that? Is there something wrong with me? Especially, I guess in my eyes, we were the same size. We definitely weren't looking back because I was so much younger. But in my eyes, being the same size as somebody that is trying to get smaller was then kind of the catalyst for me wanting to be smaller as well.
Yeah. And it's so difficult when these conversations aren't being had, but of course as a young person you do pick up on so much from your family members. And so I would imagine, you know, if there had been a dialogue there, then of course your mum would have turned around and said, like, no, of course I don't think there's anything wrong with you, you're my, you know, my perfect baby. But you pick up on, in lieu of what isn't said, you pick up on the behaviors of those you look up to. And I think a lot of listeners might be shocked by how young you were. And of course, we know that it's far from impossible that very young children can develop eating disorders. And unfortunately, that is on the rise. But I would imagine, you know, one of the challenges then for you is at that young age, in terms of like child development, you don't really have much sense of self yet at all. And so if that starts building with there's something fundamental wrong with my appearance, then that can become such a core part of your identity that then in a culture where dieting and other factors are very normalized around body pressures, I could see how a lot of people can go a long time before there's a confrontation of this is unhealthy.
Absolutely. And it's funny because when I look back to I'm 25, so I'm not old, but like, you know, my younger years as a child, I would have never said that I was on a diet. And I would have, like, you know, the word diet to me was, well, like, it's what you eat, but I would have never said to you, oh yeah, I was on a diet. But looking back, the kind of the diet I was eating was so restrictive. But like you said, when kind of everybody around you is engaging in those behaviors, to me, it was just normal. So it was almost as though, you know, when I then did get a bit older and started to make my own choices, the kind of the dieting behaviors were just normal. So I had to make them more restrictive. But equally, like you said, it was wrapped up into my identity. And I think, you know, I would never want to blame anybody, because I don't think that I don't think that's healthy, and I don't think there's any point. But, you know, there would be comments made in my family when somebody was on a diet and when they lost weight, and congratulations, like, you're doing so well, or, you know, oh, you look like you've lost weight. And I remember one memory was, I've got an older sister and my cousins are like 10 years older than me as well. So I was a bit of a surprise when I came 10 years later. But I remember sitting at my grandma's quite young, and she was like, she'd got my sister and my cousin to stand back to back to compare who was the skinniest. And when I think back to that now, I'm like, how could I have not had a complex about wanting to be smaller all the time when there was just so much praise going on for being the smallest? And also, I'm 5'1" in height. And I think another thing that has always been there is, it's almost, to me, being small means being protected. So the smaller I can make myself, the more people will want to protect me. And I think that comes down to just maybe not fitting in and not feeling like anybody like wanted to protect me. So it was just a way of being like, well, obviously, if I'm small, then everyone's going to want to kind of look after me, which just then, you know, like you said, that ties up so much into your identity. And I then was known as the small one. So how do you get out of that?
Yeah, it's so tricky. And I think a lot of people have that experience where it can become a very clear link that there's an element of it that can be like almost starving yourself out of existence. But then also, yeah, how this stuff can be positively reinforced, or how it could equally, if you were very tall, it might feel like a way to counterbalance your size in some way. And you can see how within a culture where dieting is held up as so normal without certain context, you know what I mean? There's this assumption that dieting is good, and there are many situations where it's not. And then it's easier to get into these patterns. And you reminded me of something that I don't think I've ever shared before, which was, I remember a friend of mine, when I was younger, got appendicitis, and like it was quite bad. His appendix burst. He had to have like emergency surgery for it, but he was, you know, he was okay. It's something you can generally bounce back from. And I remember when I went to see him, and obviously was like worried, and I'd never known anyone that had appendicitis before. And so I wanted to like check up on my friend. And then his mum made a comment about he'd lost a certain amount of weight whilst in the hospital recovering, not being able to eat, not feeling like he wanted to eat. And she said, well, at least as that was the phrase. And that really stuck with me. And she said it in front of him, but just all round, that was something that, yeah, I'll never forget that comment. And again, it's the extreme of that assumption that thinner is good. And so you hear people around you say, oh, you've lost weight, how great. And we know that people can lose weight for all kinds of reasons, like illness, like grief, and plenty of things where that could be actually a very upsetting comment.
Yeah, it is funny because, well, it's not funny at all, but I have a distinct memory of, I wouldn't say I was at my worst, but I was getting to the point where I was really not very well. And people, you know, when people then start to worry, because the weight loss isn't just a kind of, or you've lost a bit of weight, is kind of getting to the point where, you know, people, alarm bells start to go. And somebody came up to me at school, and I would say I was very much an in-betweener. Like, I was not cool, but I was also kind of, you know, I was in between. And this like one of the most popular girls at school came up to me, and she was like, oh, my mum saw you walking down the street the other day. She was like, oh, Hannah looks amazing now she's lost weight. And again, that was just, it's that comment of that reinforcement of, you know, someone really popular at school is now accepting me because I'm smaller now. So I must be better. When in actual fact, you know, every day I was going home and really just so depressed and anxious all the time. But none of that mattered because I'd lost weight. So that was kind of, you know, that's what everybody wanted.
And in many ways, that can then exacerbate the narrow focus when there's various forms of stress in your life. Well, this is the thing that you're used to being in charge of, and you can put so much focus when you're at your worst into controlling. And so then you can find yourself doubling down on a lot of this behaviour to then counteract the areas of stress in your life. And so during this time growing up, what was your ability to restrict in relation to like your family noticing?
I don't want to go into like specifics because I don't want to kind of,
yeah, of course,
you know, be too triggering or whatever. But I think that definitely to start with, it just seemed like, well, my dad will say now he thought it was just a phase because I was 14 years old. That's when I got kind of, well, I was 13 when it kind of, the eating disorder really kicked in. And then I was 14 when I got diagnosed with atypical anorexia, which is another thing to come on to because that in itself is an uncomfortable thing to say. But before my parents took me to the doctor, I think it just seemed like I was just, I don't know, whether it was that we didn't want to worry, so nothing was done. I don't know. But it, for me, it became really easy to restrict. And it's, I always think back now at how weird it is, because when I think about how little I was eating and how much exercise I was doing, I just don't know how I could do it, because mm-hmm. I don't know where the energy was coming from to do the exercise. But the restriction, I don't know, I think there was stuff that I hid, so I was very dishonest. And I think, but then looking back, I don't think, you know, I sat down for every meal and I was with somebody for every meal. I think I just got clever, which I think is super common, in that I don't know how or why it took a year. I guess maybe we were just hoping that it would go away, but definitely, you know, the restriction was there. And it was, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
It is tricky to explain. I definitely look back and didn't have even an awareness at the time of just how much I was restricting or how much I was engaging in other behaviours, like lying about saying that I'd eaten and I hadn't. Mm. And yeah, all these sort of things you can find yourself picking up. And, you know, even now it's tricky to not accidentally fall into certain behaviours, because I think, for me anyway, it's not oversimplifying to say that at times it can be like you're feeding off the obsessiveness of these kind of conditions, and that becomes like the fuel that you can find yourself looking back and think, how was I making it through the day and maintaining some kind of stability, like emotionally or physically or whatever, but then, well, you were so focused on this thing. That's where your energy was going. That's what your energy was coming from.
No, I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head there, because when I was engaging in the behaviours, it was almost like there was just no alternative. It had to be, that had to be the way that it was. And so it was almost, you know, there was just no other option. And I think back now and I'm like, I was literally doing my GCSEs and my A-levels at the same time. How did I kind of carry on with the restrictive behaviours and then doing the exams? But actually, I think you become, like you said, so hyper-focused that all I could think about was doing well in my exams. And so that was my main focus. I didn't see a single person. I had, like, you know, my friends just went out the door. I didn't engage with my family. I was just in my room constantly revising. And so I guess that's maybe how things kind of, quote-unquote, got away with it, because I'd go for dinner, but I'd have to eat it really quickly so I could get back to revision. So it's almost, I just forgot about eating, because it was a very conscious decision to not be eating. But it was like, oh, I'll make my dinner because I want to revise, or, you know, I will do this because I've got to get back to my studies. And actually, I think the studying was just a mask, because that was like, I'm super focused on this, so I need to disconnect from everything. But actually, I'm just so focused on my eating disorder, but I know that that wouldn't be acceptable, so the exams will cover that up.
Yeah. And it's incredible the ways that you can rationalize these things. Even at times you're very unwell, your brain can still be doing overtime because, yeah, the focus is so intense. And over this time period, what was your awareness like in terms of how dangerous these behaviors were?
That's a really difficult question. I think I knew that I was engaging in the behaviors, but I don't think I realised the impact. I knew that there was a problem and that it wasn't kind of a normal thing that somebody would go through. But equally, when I'd go for my health checks at the doctor's, it wasn't just kind of the weight that I wanted to be low. It was other things like my bloods or my blood pressure and stuff like that. There was almost a desire for them to be as low as possible or whatever. So I think at the time I had quite a lot of depression as well. And I think it was almost like getting as close to, I guess, not being here as I could, but with still being here, because I didn't want to not be here completely, but it was just sort of like dipping my toe in to see how far I could get.
Yeah. And that must have been a scary time, but were you even aware of like how bad you were getting at certain points? You know, it sounds scary to hear about, and I'm sure to look back on. But at the time, how much had you explained away the severity of this?
I think because I had nothing to compare it to in terms of other people, what they were experiencing, or maybe kind of my own experience. You know, now if that happened, I guess I've had a few more years to kind of understand things, so I could be like, okay, this is not actually great. But no, I don't think I understood the kind of severity. I think it was very like very in the moment. So again, that hyper focus of being in the moment, so not thinking about what this action right now, what the impact it's going to have on me in the future. And I don't think equally, I think when I was at the mental health service, because I'd been diagnosed with an eating disorder, the kind of depression didn't even come into it. There was never a question of, you know, how are you feeling about, I don't know, other things. It was just about the eating disorder. There was no kind of how's your mood or anything like that, that I guess now that I have had more experience would question, you know, because it goes alongside it so commonly.
Yeah, of course, and can even be brought on or be a very significant symptom of an eating disorder because of the level of stress and pressure your body's under, you know, and that can be whether you're restricting, or it could be whether you're overeating, whatever those behaviours are. But of course, we know we do need to have these different conditions acknowledged, just because understandably certain services may be more tailored to a particular mental illness, and the physical symptoms you may have been experiencing would have been severe enough to warrant certain prioritizing. That doesn't mean there can't still be space to talk through depression and symptoms that may not all relate to this condition. And so for you, what led up to getting that diagnosis and accessing services?
I think it was my mum. I was very ambivalent. I didn't think that there was an issue, but my mum wanted me to go to the doctor. So I did go to the doctor. And it's, I don't know, it's a bit of a blur, if I'm honest. I can't really remember. I think one thing that I always find really interesting is that period of my life. I have like poignant moments that I remember, but I always say, you know how they say like people don't remember the pain of pregnancy or like giving birth because your body wants you to protect you so you can have another baby. I don't really remember that time period because I think it's so painful for my brain that a lot of things are kind of not there anymore. I mean, that's my analogy. Maybe I'm just...
No, I think that's a very common experience, but also you would have been, I'm assuming, in a state of deprivation in terms of food that also then can affect your memory. Also depression can cause gaps, and that's something I've experienced as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, in the end, I went to the doctor's with my mum, and then I was referred on to CAMHS, and then I went specifically to the eating disorder service, where I was diagnosed with atypical anorexia, which I guess if people don't know is practically anorexia nervosa. So all the characteristics apart from your BMI is not less than 18.5, which was a really difficult thing to process because I'd basically been given, in my eyes, you know, I had one job, which was I wanted to lose weight. And then I was told that my weight was too high for a diagnosis of anorexia. So I felt like a massive failure, which for somebody as perfectionistic as me was quite difficult. So I think as soon as I got that diagnosis, I almost tapped out. I was like, well, I mean, you don't get it. So I didn't really give them a chance. to help me, because I just thought I've just got to keep going until I can get the quote unquote proper diagnosis.
Yeah, which is terrifying. And we've talked about it before on the show and in reference to the wonderful work Hope Virgo is doing to try and take some of these restrictions around support away so that people aren't left feeling exactly like you've described. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it must have been so horrible to have that diagnosis, that whilst I have so much respect for medical professionals and how these diagnoses are formed in many ways, that is one I have never understood, and I don't think I should, because for it to be atypical, not because of your symptoms, but instead whether or not your physical symptoms have got to a certain point, seems very counterproductive to it being a mental illness. And of course, yeah, like you say, that can drive you towards getting worse in order to get what I would argue is the accurate diagnosis anyway, mm-hmm, because the behaviours, the risk factors, so much of it is of course there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've had the conversation with so many people about why it's called atypical anorexia, and it's not just anorexia nervosa, and then we provide different treatments for people. You know, if somebody is at a much lower weight, then yes, potentially they require the nutritional support to get them up to a quote-unquote healthy BMI, and then they can engage in the psychological support, whereas maybe somebody that already has a healthy BMI can engage in the psychological support straight away. But I think it just builds a barrier to treatment, because you question, okay, but why is my diagnosis atypical? Like, I think the word itself is just so harsh. And I think ultimately it boils down to weight stigma, because I just personally can't think of anything else. But I think also what the diagnosis did was it just fed into my body dysmorphia, because I had lost about a third of my body weight to get to the point where I was, but they weren't aware of that, because I just walked into the doctors with the new weight to be told that practically I wasn't small enough. I just felt like I honestly, in my mind, I feel like the Michelin man sometimes. Like, it's that sort of, like, just I feel blown up. I feel like someone's got a pump and blown me up, and that kind of is where the body dysmorphia ties in, I think. Was, I don't know, it was all about the, I guess it wasn't all about the food. I think I used the food as a way of saying, I'm not okay, please can you help? But kind of it came from that kind of disorientation of, I don't know what my body actually looks like, and just that confusion that was with it.
Yeah, of course. And for you, when you got the diagnosis, was there a diagnosis related to body dysmorphia as well, or was that considered to be a symptom of the eating disorder?
So the body dysmorphia, so when I got diagnosed with atypical anorexia, I was 14. I got re-diagnosed at 21, no, 20, and then the body dysmorphia I wasn't diagnosed with until 22. So it took 8 years of treatment for the body dysmorphia to be recognised. So that was hard.
Yeah, of course. And it's a difficult one to even describe to people, because there can be so much misconceptions around eating disorders. Of course, you know that. And certain elements are admittedly quite confusing. So, like, body dysmorphia, mm, for me, I've had as a symptom of an eating disorder. And it has also contributed in some ways towards depression, but it's not been something that was a separate diagnosable thing. The main sort of way it fitted in for me was that preceded the eating disorder. And so that was sort of a mixture of an early symptom and its own thing until it grew and wasn't its own thing anymore. But even that's not commonly misunderstood. A lot of people don't know either that it's its own condition that can be diagnosable, or they maybe don't know that it's a symptom of actually a whole range of conditions, including those that aren't eating disorders.
Yeah. And I think for me, I think it might have been the other way around, because, I mean, I don't know, but I would say that the kind of thing that's been there consistently is the body dysmorphia. So I think that maybe it was the body dysmorphia and then the eating disorder was a component of that to control things, in an attempt to control things. But equally, like what you've just said there, in that it doesn't have to be related to an eating disorder. I think when I finally got diagnosed with the body dysmorphia, it was such a, I guess, a relief, because there'd often be cases where I'd look in the mirror and my eyebrows, and this kind of sounds, well, it's not silly, but like one felt like it was literally like a V shape and the other felt like an arch. To, I guess, somebody that wasn't hyper focused on their image or their perception of their self or themselves, that wouldn't be something. But to me, like, that controlled my whole day, and I'd spend hours and hours trying to sort of like manipulate my eyebrows and make them look different. And then, kind of, you know, a few hours later, if I'd have then calmed my mood, because it always tends to happen either when I'm very anxious or when I'm really low, my eyebrows would be back to the shape they were. And I could never explain it, going from, you know, looking in the mirror and feeling like completely so ugly and I couldn't even recognize myself, to then kind of back to normal Hannah. Like, it felt so disorientating and I just couldn't explain it. But then actually getting the diagnosis, I was like, wow, like, that's where that's coming from. Mm-hmm. And it's not just my body that's affected, it's all of me that's affected.
Yeah, and I think this is exactly why it's so key to have, of course, the right diagnosis, and indeed, you know, the multiple diagnoses, if that's relevant for you, because we want to get the picture. You know, we can find all these links, but oftentimes we need those external tools of the medical professionals assessing us fully. And you're right, it can be a strange thing to describe when you're not in that headspace. Like, I often describe from a very young age how I would look in the mirror and it would be like looking at a Picasso painting. You know, the dysmorphia would be that extreme that your face would seem a different shape, or yeah, parts of your face seemed like misaligned and things like that. And it's very difficult to describe to somebody without it sounding like you're exaggerating or you're being dramatic if they haven't had that experience. But of course,
yeah,
it is actually very common. And I think one of the things I worry about a lot is how, in many ways, it's difficult to draw the boundaries on this because of how much certain pressures on our appearance and certain things within, like, the media we consume is warped. And so, you know, even people that don't have experience of this can still find themselves using filters enough that they don't feel they look quite like themselves without a filter. And that, to me, is body dysmorphia. But of course, there's a whole conversation about it being a spectrum and how far that goes before it's then diagnosable or it's a significant problem to examine. But but I worry about how it's becoming both more extreme in some ways and also that extremity being normalised, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's sort of eating disorders and body dysmorphia, both of them are kind of following the same thing, because if you think about disordered eating patterns, they're so normalised now. Like, you know, you just, everybody seems to have a particular thing that is, I mean, I guess not everybody, but I think kind of disordered eating especially is so much more common. And I think that's what makes recovery so hard, is because you're almost, you recognize these behaviors and they are controlling your life. So you're trying to step out of them, but you're stepping out of them into a world where they're normalized. So, you know, for me, there'd be certain food groups that I wouldn't eat. And then I'd be stepping out into a world where none of my friends ate them. My family didn't eat them. And I distinctly remember when I got the meal plan from CAMHS, my mum was like, "We're not eating this. We never eat this sort of food." And I was just like, well, you know, we've fallen at the first hurdle then, because the point of this is not that I'm going to eat those foods for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. It's that I'm absolutely terrified to eat them and I need to gain weight. So that's why they're on there. But I think that's another reason why my treatment didn't work, was because everything that they suggested, I think, you know, our family unfortunately has quite a few disordered behaviours anyway. So then it was like the whole family needed to kind of mix up their diet, which I think is really hard to say out loud. And makes recovery difficult when your system at home is not kind of following what I guess the service wants you to follow.
Yeah, it's really tricky, and it very much parallels with a lot of people's experiences, like, for example, how many people are in counselling. And one of the main reasons they're there is to deal with the people in their life that they wish would go to counselling. And often those can be close family members. And you're right, so much is normalised. So much can be normalised, whether it's culturally or within, you know, family, friend groups, whatever kind of social context. Mm-hmm. And for you then, what sort of help were you able to find that did help?
Kind of, I guess there's like a two kind of stage journey to this. So the CAMHS treatment unfortunately didn't help. Whether that was because I was ambivalent, I don't know. But then when I went to university, I joined a powerlifting club, which was great to start with because I wanted to get strong. So I needed to eat in order to get strong. But I think it went from eating to lift to lifting to eat. And it just became, again, because my identity had gone from Hannah with the eating disorder to Hannah, the girl who lifts weights, that just became the next thing that I wanted to control. But with that, with the powerlifting, there was a lot of kind of long sessions, like life revolved around powerlifting. And then when I went to do my first competition, I could have just gone into one weight category, but a lot of my peers that were in the society kind of like cut down into a different weight class. So in my mind, the normal thing to do would be to cut down into another weight class. And obviously that was an excuse to lose weight. So I was very much on board, but I got so wrapped up into it and became so manipulative towards my diet and kind of lost a lot of social connections again, that my two really good friends in the club just sat me down and they were like, you can't do this. Like, if this is the way that you're going to approach it, this is so unhealthy. So that's when I went back to an adult eating disorder service and I got diagnosed with atypical anorexia again. And I was just like, I'm not doing this. Like, I don't want to keep having kind of this diagnosis thrown in my face.
Yeah.
So I then kind of continued with the powerlifting. Things started to get a bit better, but I think I was just functioning rather than actually being recovered. But then kind of when I was 22, I then got to the point where I couldn't be at home on my own because of the depression had got so bad. And my boyfriend was going out to work and I was doing my master's, but he just couldn't leave me. So I actually reached out to an EMDR therapist, and that's kind of when I finally started getting the help that I needed. And that's when the body dysmorphia got diagnosed. So we really were able to unpack that. So that was what worked for me.
I'm reminding myself, I know what it is, but I was like, for the listeners, we'll give the full title. Mm-hmm. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And with that particular kind of treatment, that's not the one I would have expected. I think partly just because of how commonly through NHS services, people are referred for like more person-centered or particularly CBT. And yet, yeah, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing as a therapeutic approach, I understand how impactful it can be in terms of breaking down some of these cognitive links and these kind of patterns of behaviour so that you can explore the like broader psychological context. And I think it's sort of paralleled with what you mentioned earlier of like when people are at certain points in terms of how dangerous them being underweight has become, there has to be certain prioritizing because there can be so much that is difficult to access, like memories, like holding concentration when your weight is so extremely low that then that impacts how useful therapies can be. And so can you talk through like what the process was like in terms of this approach if people are unfamiliar and how it helped for you?
Sure. So say as well, I initially was referred for CBT, but unfortunately it wasn't something that worked for me. I think I often see CBT as the iceberg, and in my personal opinion, you need to go below the iceberg, but I know that it can work for some people. So I was in a very fortunate position in that I could reach out to a private therapist, which is how I then got the EMDR. But basically, like, when she first explained it to me, I was kind of sat there thinking, this is all a bit, like, frou-frou, sounds a bit kind of magical. And the way that she described it was that you have in your amygdala, so a part in your brain, you have lots of memories and stuff, and that's what kind of contributes to your conscious thoughts. And if you imagine that the little memories are like little ribenas that are all running round, when you do the processing, which is basically all that it involves is bilateral stimulation. So it could be that the therapist will sort of wave their finger from left to right and you follow it with your eyes. Or I also did one during the pandemic where I kind of crossed my two thumbs over, and then you have two like anxiety pressure points on your chest, and so you alternatively tap them. And then I think there's also one that you can kind of do by like tapping your legs. But basically what the bilateral stimulation does is as you talk about a topic, and then you kind of like start talking about things as you're watching the fingers move, and then memories associated with that phrase come up for you. And so it's quite difficult, and often if it's kind of related to things involving trauma, it can be a really difficult process, because basically those memories sort of come up, and then you replace those memories with a more positive or a more healthy frame of mind. So then over the next 72 hours, which can be the most hard and difficult 72 hours, you're reprocessing all of those thoughts. So it might be that in your dreams, you relive those memories, or kind of, I would find that all of a sudden I would just be so anxious and I'd just have to curl up into a ball in my room and cry. But then after those 72 hours, after the reprocessing, you then start to have a more positive mindset towards things, or your focus has shifted a bit. So I did one actually a few weeks ago, which was the most powerful one that I've done, where I basically had to draw how I see myself. And we then did the reprocessing, and then I had to redraw myself. And honestly, the transformation was just incredible, as to it had gone from something very disordered to maybe something, I mean, I still don't think I can see what I actually look like, but that seemed more kind of normal for my body. And then the next day I went and looked in the mirror, and bearing in mind, you know, at my worst, I was probably checking myself in the mirror 150 times a day. I just sort of looked and I was like, that's me. And there was just no like picking apart of anything or staring at it or kind of over like dwelling on it or whatever. It was crazy. And I just ran into my boyfriend and I was like, I've just looked at myself in the mirror and didn't feel anything. He was like, yeah. I was like, that doesn't happen. Like, yeah. There's normally so much
body
there.
Neutrality is not accessible to a lot of people. Yeah. No, that's brilliant. And what kind of things have you then included in terms of your like day-to-day life as well in order to help your recovery?
One thing that I found recently, and especially after the kind of pandemic, is connection to other people. I think I've always felt that I was introverted, but I think I've decided that I'm actually an introverted extrovert. So I get my happiness from seeing other people, connecting with other people, but I do need my own space. But I'm now very in tune with when I need that. But I notice if I do disconnect a bit, that's when I get to my lowest again. So yeah, connecting with other people is definitely a top priority. I think making sure that I do exercise, but doing exercise that I know I will enjoy, rather than the compulsive exercise that it's been for so long. Now it's just doing some form of movement that kind of releases some endorphins and makes me feel good. And then the other thing that I'm doing that is a conscious effort, but I know it's making me feel better, is journaling. It's something I've been so against for so long because I could just never be bothered. But I have a journal next to my bed now. And every day when I go to bed, I just write what I'm thinking and I close it and it's done. And it takes me like a minute max. But just by having it there makes me do it. And it's helping so much as well to just kind of unpack everything before I go to sleep.
I love that. And yeah, I hear that from a lot of people, which is why I chuckled, that it could be easy to feel like cynical of the journaling, or it feels like it's too simple to make such a difference. But yeah, I think it's as much about like the habit of getting this stuff outside of your brain as it is like, you know, anything to do with it. The book is the book. It doesn't matter what the journal looks like. It's, you know, it's that process of getting the thoughts out. And we all do that in different ways. So thank you so much for this conversation. I know we've talked about a lot of serious topics that I connect to really personally, but I found like your approach very uplifting. And I love, as you know, I love the rest of your work as well. So could you share a bit about your work, where people can find you, and all of that fun stuff?
Yeah. Sure. So I also have a podcast, which is called Full of Beans. It's a eating disorder awareness podcast. And the aim of the podcast is basically to reduce stigma and increase awareness. But with that, I speak to a whole range of individuals. And my focus really is to share the unheard voices. So to get people speaking on the podcast about their research maybe that they're doing in a new area of eating disorders, or the treatment that they provide that isn't the standardized treatment, or an experience that they've had that isn't maybe, you know, the stereotypical eating disorder, really in hope to just share as many experiences as possible, so that if somebody's listening, they can take some tips, they can connect whatever they need in that moment. So that is on Instagram, and on Twitter is the FOB podcast, so the FOB podcast. So yeah, if you want to check it out, please feel free. Loads, and I think I'm on episode 50 now. So yeah, it's nearly coming to a year, which is a bit crazy, but there's lots of different topics on there. So hopefully there'll be one that will be right for someone to listen to.
Oh, I would stand by it. Yeah, absolutely. Because I have to commend you on the breadth of different perspectives. You know, that can be so tricky. And one of, as you talk about in your own show, one of the big issues around eating disorders is that broadly people do not realise how common certain ones are, and think that certain ones are the most common because they're the most talked about. And so, yeah, I really appreciate your work, and we try and do the same here on the show.
Absolutely.
How can we get the different perspectives in? So thank you for sharing yours.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely.
Oh, also, we shouldn't forget to plug, I will be appearing on that show too, and plenty of our previous guests here. You can hear more from them on your podcast as well. Yeah. I love it. I have to say on air, you did a really cute like thumbs up pose. So cute. Love it. Full of beans. Lives up to the title.
Good. That is partly why it's called Full of Beans. It's because everyone was like, my energy is very like, full of beans.
Okay.
So.
Well, actually, as you brought it up, can I ask you then? So I kind of assumed that. Is there an element that relates to beans? I was like, maybe she's also obsessed with beans. Is it a pun, or is that the...
There's kind of four elements, which is a bit excessive, but
okay,
whatever.
Let's hear about
so them. There's... One is the full of beans, as in because I'm a pretty energetic, full of beans person. Two is full of beans because like you're opening a can of beans, like opening a can of worms. Uh-huh. So like when everyone's sharing their story, you're opening a can of worms. Three was full of beans because they're super nutritious. So it was kind of like, it's a great thing to kind of tie into eating disorders if you're full of beans, and that's great. And then the fourth one was my two friends that I mentioned were the people that kind of sat me down and said, you need to go back to the eating disorder service. All they used to eat was beans on toast. So that kind of ties back into them as well.
Oh, I love that. I love all the layers. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, we'll wrap up there. Thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Missing minerals? 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's missing, naturally supporting mood, energy, and immunity. Get yours now at TraceMinerals.com.